Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 24th podcast. My name's John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, including a very special guest and some news on the recent trade made by the Cubs and White Sox, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, Instagram, and LinkedIn, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area for arts and crafts, check out Moochie World, a place where inspiration meets creation. You can check them out at MoochieWorld.com. Their address is 7913 171st Street in Tinley Park. You can call them at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. So, we start off today talking about the big news in Chicago sports this week. That is the crosstown deal, sending Jose Quintana to the Cubs for a plethora of young prospects. We'll get to those guys in a minute, but first, let's talk about Jose Quintana and what he brings to the table for the Cubs. This year is Quintana's 28-year-old season. So far, he's 5-8 now with a 4.20 ERA thanks to a great outing in his first appearance with the Cubs as he went 7 strong innings, giving up no runs and striking out 12. But Quintana, as a pitcher on his own, has been a guy who suffered from being on a bad team and having bad luck. Now, what I mean by that is this. His career record is 51-54. He's only had one season in which he finished above 500 as far as wins and losses go, and that was last year when he went 13-12. Yet, take a look at this, which might surprise you. His career ERA is 3.49. And in 2014 and 2015, he went to combined 18-21, despite his average ERA of those 2 years being at 3.34. So Quintana is a very good pitcher who's put up some pretty good numbers considering the way MLB has been going with the offensive output, especially this season. But Quintana's been doing a great job his entire career. I mean, his highest ERA was in his rookie year at 3.76, and you have to discount the fact that he only made 25 starts that year. Since then, he's made 33 or 32 starts in each season following. This year, he's at 19. So Quintana is a durable guy and a guy who has simply suffered from being on a bad team and having no run support. Last season as well, he finished 10th in the Cy Young Award voting and actually was an AL All-Star. So a guy who flies under the radar yet will give you quality innings and will pitch to an ERA of 3.5 or below. I mean, that's a great deal for the Cubs considering their best starter's ERA at the moment without Quintana in the picture is Jake Arrieta at 4.17, followed by John Lester close behind at 4.25. And that's been a problem for the Cubs. I mean, you look back to last season, Hendricks, Lester, Cy Young Award candidates, Arrieta pitched to an ERA of 3.10. That's the reason the Cubs really went far in the playoffs and ended up winning the World Series. This year, however, they've struggled to have a pitcher pitch to an ERA under 4. So when you get a guy like Quintana, who has a track record of an ERA under 4, and even ERAs under 3.5 in most cases, you're doing something right. Now, unfortunately for the Cubs, they did give up a haul to get Quintana, so for the White Sox, as we transition to their end of the bargain, they truly made out like a bandit because they got prospects that are going to help them win that coveted World Series down the road in 2020 or a bit later. The Sox in total got 4 prospects, 2 of which are better than the other 2. First is Eloy Jimenez, a center fielder slash shortstop, who was ranked 8th in all of baseball as far as the top 100 prospects go. And here's an interesting tidbit. The Cubs actually signed him when he was the number 1 overall prospect internationally back in 2013. That's when the Cubs, during their rebuild, had a lot of international signing bonus money, so they decided to pool it all to sign Eloy Jimenez. Ironically, they ended up trading him with this deal. They also got Dylan Cease, who's ranked number 63 in the top 100. He's a right-handed pitcher, and this season in single-A South Bend, he has a 1-2 record, yet a 2.79 ERA. They also got first baseman Matt Rose and infielder Bryant Fleet. So I want to focus on the first two, again, Jimenez and Cease. Here's a scouting report on Jimenez and what he brings to the table. Quote, Jimenez was signed for his bat and his body. One club official admiringly called him a physical animal and has started to deliver. His body evokes comparisons with former Cub Jorge Soler and Marlins outfielder Giancarlo Stanton, but he's more than just a power first hitter. Some scouts rank Jimenez's pure hitting ability on par with his power, or put 60 grades on his hitting and 70 on his power on the 20 to 80 scouting scale. While his walk rate is modest, Jimenez improved his strike zone judgment in 2016 by seeing more pitches per at-bat, identifying spin more, and applying the Cubs' selective aggressive mantra. So Jimenez is a stud hitter, and the problem with him is, at least according to this scouting report, is that his arm is his weakest tool. Quote, his throws lack carry, though he has become more accurate. He had only one outfield assist in 2016 and has five in his career. He has a chance for an average arm, though, if he dedicates himself to a throwing program, end quote. So Jimenez will have trouble on the field as far as arm strength goes, but as long as his bat continues to shine, I'm sure the White Sox will find a place to put him in the lineup. As for Cease, here's what happened for him last year in the minors. He threw 45 innings at short season Eugene and showed an outstanding fastball at 95 to 101 miles per hour that led to 13.3 strikeouts per 9 innings. His control, changeup, and the consistency of his breaking ball all need work, but it was a strong sign of what's to come. By the way, both those scouting reports courtesy of BaseballAmerica.com. So Cease, on the other hand, he needs some more development yet, and we see him in single-A right now, doing good with the South Bend Cubs, of course, the 2.79 ERA I alluded to earlier. And as the scouting report says itself, his only problem will be his control, but again, that'll get better with age and with more experience at the minor and eventually major league level. So now comes the question, as usual, who won the trade here? Now, everybody's saying it's a win-win. Sure, the Cubs got Quintana, somebody they need right now. And the White Sox got guys who are going to help them in their future, which is good, considering they're not in win-now mode. I think both teams did win, but I have a problem with the amount of players the Cubs gave up. Jimenez was one of the Cubs' best prospects, number 8 in all of baseball. And heck, they used all their international signing money to get him in the first place. To just trade him away, I think, was a bit reckless. Maybe they could have given up someone else like Mark Zagunas or Victor Caratini, two guys who had played very little at the major league level who are still considered high-end prospects. Again, though, I'm not complaining because the Cubs needed Quintana. They need starters who can go past the sixth inning and who could pitch to an ERA under 4.0. So at this point, sure, it's a win-win, but we'll see down the road what Quintana continues to do for the Cubs and what these two prospects do for the White Sox. And before we move on to the Chicago Bulls, just one more point regarding the trade. It's kind of an interesting stat that I found on Twitter. The last time the Cubs and White Sox made a trade was in 2006 when they swapped David Aardsma and Neil Kotz to relievers. Well, we're going to move on now to the Chicago Bulls and their summer league. They ended the summer league season with a 99-82 victory over the 76ers, and of course, wins and losses are nice, but it doesn't make a difference when talking about summer league. What really matters is the progress and development of some of their young players. Now, someone you really have to watch out for who will be donning a Bulls uniform this coming season is number 7 overall draft selection, Lauri Markkanen. He's been compared to Dirk Nowitzki because he's a 7-foot guy who can still shoot threes and rebound at an incredible pace. Here are some stats on him as far as the summer league goes. He didn't do that well in Game 2, shooting 0-for-11 from 3-point range, and he received a lot of scorn from both Chicago and national television hosts about his presence in the NBA and if he was fit to play in the NBA. However, he silenced all those quote-unquote haters by putting up a 20-and-10 game along with 4 3-pointers in Game 3. He showed aggression in dunking the ball as well as his post-game, and has the chance to back up Nikola Mirotic, assuming his contract situation is figured out. Again, when I talk about Markkanen, I cannot stress how much of an upside he has, considering that the guy is 7 foot, can rebound, can shoot 3-pointers, and can perform in the post when needed. I mean, this guy is starting to remind me of a Carl Anthony Towns per se, at least when talking about a contemporary example, a guy who could shoot the three-point ball, yet could also rebound and score. And for reference, Towns last season scored 2,061 points, which broke the Timberwolves franchise record for most points in a season. So again, watch out for Lauri Markkanen coming up this year for the Bulls. Here are some notes on some other guys, including Chris Dunn, who was acquired in exchange for Jimmy Butler. Now, Dunn didn't have much of a chance to lead the team. He left after one game due to a family emergency. In that one game that he played, he scored 11 points on 3 of 12 shooting. I can tell you that last season was his rookie year. He was the backup to Ricky Rubio, and here are some statistics. In 17.1 minutes played last year, Dunn scored only 3.8 points per game and 2.4 assists per game. If you look at a per 36-minute scale, those numbers would be inflated to 7.9 points, 5.1 assists. So Dunn certainly has some work to do, considering that he is a former first-round pick. Hopefully, he could turn things around with the Bulls this season, as he is the projected starting point guard now that Rajon Rondo has signed a one-year deal to go to the Pelicans. As far as Cameron Payne goes, he had a pair of odd games. He did average 11.5 points, but he shot 9 of 26. One thing I will say about Payne is that I do not believe in him. I was not happy when the Bulls first got him for Taj Gibson and Doug McDermott, and I'm not happy with him now. His performance last season was mediocre, if you ask me, and after this summer league game in which he shot 9 of 26, I mean, that's just unacceptable. If you're a point guard in the NBA, you should know how to shoot a basketball. So for Cameron Payne, he has a lot of work to do, and now he has competition from Chris Dunn and Jerian Grant for that starting point guard spot. For Payne right now, at least based on projections, he'll be the third guy out, which means he won't get much playing time. He needs to improve if he wants to see some time on the court. And finally, I want to take a look at Jerian Grant, who had quite a good summer, at least when compared to last summer as a rookie. He shot 10 of 38 from threes, but showed more versatility at the shooting guard position compared to last season. In his last game, he had 21.6 assists and 5 rebounds. And according to Bulls.com beat writer Sam Smith, Valentine has a chance to start at shooting guard this year for the Bulls, depending on the contract status of Dwayne Wade. And that's good for Valentine because it's shown that he's put in the work to become a quality NBA player. Of course, he was this big superstar at Michigan State, and last season had some growing pains, but it's nice to see him develop into more of an option for the Bulls, whether it's on the bench or in the starting lineup. And with that, we're going to move on now and talk about the Chicago Bears. Training camp starts at the end of July, and there's an intriguing situation for the team as far as positional battles goes, and that is the wide receiver spot. The Bears have a number of veteran wide receivers that they have signed to compete in training camp, and they have a bunch of holdovers as well. So now the question is, who will they retain? Here's a list of the guys who will be trying out, quote-unquote, for the wide receiver spot. Victor Cruz, Reuben Randle, Marcus Wheaton, Kendall Wright, Cameron Meredith, Kevin White, Josh Bellamy, Deontay Thompson, and Daniel Braverman. Now, first of all, let's think about guys who are most likely going to make the team. First off, Cameron Meredith last season led the Bears in receiving yards, and yes, he did beat out Alshon Jeffrey, so I think he's a lock, and hopefully for him, he can hold on to that number one wide receiver spot. I think Kevin White as well is not a lock, but has a chance, a good chance, to make the team, mostly because of his status as a former first-round pick. He's yet to show much, which is why this year could be a make-or-break year for him. As far as holdovers goes, those are the only two who have a legitimate chance, because Victor Cruz and Marcus Wheaton and Kendall Wright, if you want to count his days with the Titans, are all proven wide receivers who have a very good opportunity to crack those 3, 4, and 5 wide receiver positions. Now, Victor Cruz used to be a superstar. He was on top of the NFL with Eli Manning, and the Giants back in 2011, he helped them win the Super Bowl by catching 82 passes for 1,536 yards and 9 touchdowns. The season after, he also recorded over 1,000 yards and 10 touchdowns. His only problem is injuries, which is common for a lot of superstars in the NFL. Cruz was derailed for 6 games in the 2014 season when he tore a patellar tendon in his right knee, and he's been often injured since that original injury back in 2014. So his problem will be, obviously, staying on the field. I think if he gets through training camp unharmed, he'll have a very good opportunity to make the team based on his track record. And the Bears could also view it as a veteran presence who has been to the Super Bowl before. He could coach up these younger wide receivers and show them what it's really like to be a wideout in the NFL. Marcus Wheaton is another guy who's interesting. Now, I'm a fan of Marcus Wheaton because he had some good days with the Steelers as a legitimate deep threat with Ben Roethlisberger. Wheaton caught 53 passes for 644 yards in 2014 and 44 passes for 749 yards in 2015. A torn labrum, however, hurt him for last season, and he ended up having surgery on it in early December. So that's going to be a problem for him, obviously, recovering from that torn labrum. But if Wheaton can go back to the 2014 and 2015 version of himself, I think he too will make the team based on the fact that he'll be, along with Cam Meredith, two of the best deep threats on this team. And finally, Kendall Wright, and he's an interesting guy because he actually played under Dowell Logans, who is currently the Bears offensive coordinator, back when they were members of the Titans. And here's something quite ironic about Wright. When Logans was a part of the Titans, he had the best offensive years of his career. In his first two seasons with the Titans, he caught 64 passes for 626 yards, then 94 passes for 1,079 yards and 2 touchdowns. That was back in 2012 and 2013. So Kendall Wright, another guy who was simply the best wide receiver on the Tennessee Titans before the exit of Dowell Logans and before the arrival of Marcus Mariota. Due to that connection, combined with the fact that Wright did so well under Dowell Logans, I feel that he has a very good opportunity to make the team because he'll be able to replicate his success that he had with the Titans. Those are 4 guys, meaning that there's 1 spot left, and that last spot will be up for grabs between Reuben Randall, Josh Bellamy, Deontay Thompson, and Daniel Braverman. Now, I can narrow down the list a bit. Josh Bellamy last season, and I'm sure if you're a Bears fan, you saw him on TV, he dropped a lot of passes. He even dropped a game-winning pass in the end zone from Matt Barkley at the time. So his chances are going to be small, I think, because the Bears have seen him for a full season in game situations and have seen the fact that he has just simply dropped footballs for no apparent reason. Deontay Thompson, in my opinion, has the best chance of staying on the team because he has acted as the Bears' kick returner and punt returner, along with being the team's 5th receiver. Because of that versatility and because of his success as far as special teams goes, I think Thompson will end up making the team and getting that 5th wide receiver spot. Well, we're going to move on now and talk about the Chicago Blackhawks. And there is some sad news to report. Brian Campbell, after 17 seasons in the NHL, has announced his retirement from the league. Campbell, if you might remember, was a key part of 3 playoff teams with the Hawks, and he ended up helping them win the 2010 Stanley Cup. This past season, Campbell signed a discounted deal of 1 year, $2.25 million, to return to the Hawks and have a second stint with them. So it's unfortunate to see him go, especially when considering the amount of veterans that the Hawks already have lost. I mean, Nicholas Hjalmarsson, Johnny Oduya, Trevor Van Riemsdyk, and now Campbell are gone from the team. To top that off, Marian Hossa is most likely out for the entire season with an undisclosed injury. Now, although the Hawks have brought back Patrick Sharp and Brandon Saad due to a trade that involved Michael Panarin, they still have a gaping hole on defense, and that's something they're going to need to patch up before the season begins. Now, Campbell won't be away from the Hawks. He actually joined their business operations department, where he will assist with marketing, community relations, and youth hockey initiatives. Here's a quote from Campbell. "I'm excited to transition into the next step in both my professional career and life. I'm grateful to the countless number of teammates, coaches, team staff, and fans that I have crossed paths with throughout my playing career in Chicago, Buffalo, Florida, and San Jose. The Blackhawks organization has allowed me to take on this challenge, and I'm thankful for this new opportunity." Well, Brian, we're sad to see you go, but we are thankful for your contributions to this Chicago Blackhawks team, and even more grateful that you are still with the Hawks organization. Congratulations on your retirement. And with that, it's time for our special guest. Let me tell you a bit about him. He is a two-time All-Star pitcher and former world champion as a member of the Boston Red Sox. He spent 8.5 years as a member of the Cubs, serving as both a shutdown closer and effective starting pitcher. Today, he is an assistant to Cubs general manager Jed Hoyer and an analyst on MLB Network. Please welcome Ryan Dempster to the show. So, Ryan, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. I'm doing great, actually. Just enjoying my time out here this week in New York and doing a little analyst work, so it's fun.
Well, I'm sure you have heard, as well as everyone else, about the news regarding the Cubs and their decision to acquire Jose Quintana. What are your thoughts on the deal, and what kind of spark do you think Quintana brings to the team?
Yeah, well, obviously, it's a great deal. It's one of those deals that, you know, ultimately can be great for both ball clubs. You get the opportunity to acquire a starting pitcher with controllability for 3 years past this, a guy who's, you know, at times been pitching like a number one, but mostly, I mean, you know, whether you want to rank them or whatever, he is one of the top starting pitchers in the big leagues. And, you know, to get another left-hander, a fresh arm in there, he's been, you know, it's a great move. And then for the White Sox, for them to be able to get some talent that they're looking to do, rebuild down there on the south side of Chicago and acquire some prospects. And, but just, you know, an all-around great trade, an opportunity here to breathe some life into that rotation and give a fresh start to the second half.
You know, when I saw this deal occur, it kind of reminded me of a deal that you were a part of back with the Cubs in 2012, where you were traded to a contender for multiple prospects. Now, your situation at the time is similar to Quintana's right now. So with that in mind, can you describe what it was like to leave a franchise so dear to you for a contender mid-season?
Yeah, you know, that's always tough. It's always tough to leave somewhere where you kind of come up and you make a name for yourself and you establish yourself in somewhere that you love being. And, you know, I think that's one thing that probably stands out the most, that the best positive for him is, he always talks about how much he loves Chicago and he loved being in Chicago. Well, guess what? Now you just have to take a different route to the ballpark. That's all. You know, you're on a different side of town, but you're still in the same city where you love being, and you don't have to uproot your family and move your family anywhere. And, it's kind of interesting too, right around the corner here in a few days, he'll be facing his old mates and seeing them. So, it's always, a ton of emotions. You feel a lot of different things when you get traded, but at the end of the day, you just go out there and do the best you can to help your new ball club and do your job. And that's go out there and make pitches and try and win ball games. And, you know, he's going to do a great job of that.
So shifting gears to your career, I wanted to focus on your time with the Cubs for a moment. You were the team's shutdown closer for 3 years in a row and did great. What prompted you to transition back to a starting pitching role in 2008? And how were you able to do so well in that transition?
I think part of it always inside before that was, being a starting pitcher. Starting in Florida, starting in Cincinnati. So I always had that drive and that, desire to go back to the rotation. And then when Lou presented it to me that, I was going to do it in 2008 and to go home that off season and get ready to do that, always trained hard, but I think I put more physical effort into that off season than I ever had because I knew how much that transition was, how much hard work it was going to be, how difficult it was going to be. And so I knew that physically I had to be ready. I figured mentally I could do it. It's just a physical aspect and was able to slide in there nicely, make an all-star team my first year back and then, you know, stay there the rest of my career. But I had a blast doing both of them. The closing thing is sometimes it can be a little tough, but I enjoyed it, the adrenaline rush of it. But I definitely enjoyed the starting pitching and having those days in between starts and doing what I could there.
By the way, the Cubs team of 2008, the one where you became a starter once again, was quite a special one, with you guys winning 97 games and the NL Central Division title. Did you believe that you guys were capable of ending the Cubs World Series drought at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the 07 team, we had a good team. But the 08 team, we were stacked, man. And we had all the pieces of the puzzle to get it done, and we didn't. And, you know, a lot of that, the tone gets set in the first game. We got the Dodgers, and the Dodgers were playing great baseball going into that series. They were hot as could be and playing really well, but at the end of the day, the starting pitching in that series didn't pitch like we were capable of. I went out there, I walked seven guys in that first game and gave up a big grand slam, and just never kind of got what we needed to get out of that, and then it just steamrolled downhill after that. But we were put together so well, a lot of depth, good balance, good bullpen, good rotation, and we just didn't get it done. But I thought for sure that was the time it was going to happen.
Now, although that 2008 team did not win the World Series, you helped the Boston Red Sox win it all in 2013. So how rectifying was that for you, considering that you waited your entire career to get that ring?
Oh, my gosh, man. Just absolutely meant the world. And, you know, when you get to the playoffs, you think you're just always going to get there and you're going to be there. And you understand and realize that those are hard to come by, and especially getting to a World Series and having that opportunity to get back there in 2013 with the Red Sox was so special. We had an unbelievable team, a great bunch of guys, really driven by the same thing, and that was winning a championship and nothing else, not by money or any of that stuff. So we just we steamrolled some teams and completely undeterred. Our plan was undeterred. We knew we were going to win it, and to go out that way and win a championship in my last season was pretty cool.
So in that 2013 season, you also did something that made national headlines. During a game at Fenway Park, you faced Alex Rodriguez at the plate and threw three straight balls on the inside part of the plate before hitting him. First off, was that intentional? And if it was, what was the reasoning behind it?
Okay. What a great question. I never heard that before. No, you know what? I think at the end of the day, just trying to send a message. I obviously wasn't happy with a lot of the things that, you know, were going on in that whole situation. And to be honest with you, I just, it started way before any of all that when, I signed with the Red Sox. Me and my brothers were having a celebratory ice cold beverage together up in Vancouver. And I just said, hey, you know what I'm going to do? The first time I face A-Rod at Fenway, I'm going to hit him. That way I never have to pay for another beer for the rest of my life when I'm in Boston. And it worked out. Last time I was there, when the Cubs were there earlier this year, I didn't pay for any beers. So, it is what it was. It was, one of those moments where, people say, do you regret doing it? And I say, no, you know, we live with what we do. And, I'm glad I was the guy who was able to put my foot down and say we weren't happy with what was going on.
So you ended up retiring after that eventful 2013 season, but made a comeback this past year in the World Baseball Classic as a pitcher for Team Canada. Why did you decide to make a comeback, and did you receive any offers to return to the MLB?
To decide to do it, I just, you know, I always had kind of had this part of me that wished that I played in the WBC and just didn't before because of pitching in the regular season. And for me personally, I just always was trying to get ready for the start of the season and didn't want to get ready too early. So, I just loved it. I thought it was so much fun to get ready again, to ramp up like that, and to show my kids too that if you want to try so hard for something and not be afraid, you know, don't be afraid to fail. If you fail, so what? At least the opportunity to push yourself to do something and to do it after 3.5 years of not playing baseball like at all was a big challenge. But stuff-wise, it was there. The game against the Dominican to open the tournament, so it was a tough draw when you're facing an all-star team like that. But a little bit crisper, a little bit sharper, maybe a pitch here or there, maybe the results would have been a little bit different. But no offers afterwards. But then again, I made it let known that I wasn't making a comeback of that sort. So I just wanted a chance to put Canada across my chest and see if I could help us win some ball games, and it just didn't quite work out that way.
So your career as a whole was one of success and longevity. I was wondering if it had something to do with your mechanics, because when thinking about your pitching mechanics, the mitt wiggle immediately comes to mind. It was something that was different yet successful. So why did you wiggle your mitt in your delivery, and what purpose did it serve?
Yeah, it was actually kind of an interesting story. So back in spring training going into the 2008 season, we were in a situation where I had now all of a sudden for 3 years, I'd been thrown out of the stretch position as a closer, and I developed my split finger fastball. Well, I don't have big, huge hands that could just reach in and grab the split finger fastball. I'd have to preset it. And when I would come ready for the windup, I was throwing a bullpen one day and before spring training, and Tyler Colvin, one of our outfielders, said, "Do you mind if I stand in?" And I said, "No problem, get in there." And so I was throwing pitches to him, and he just came up to me and he said, "Hey, by the way, I can tell when you're not throwing a split anymore because your wrist moves." And so then I started wiggling my glove a little bit and doing that. And next thing you know, it kind of became the Dempster glove waggle. And I remember walking by a ballpark one day in Chicago, a little school park, and I'm towing my son in the wagon. He's a young kid, and I just looked at him and I said, "Hey, some kid's sitting there going, 'I'm Ryan Dempster,' and he's waking up his glove." And I just looked at my son, and I go, "He's talking about your dad right there. Look at that, huh?" So it was pretty cool. A really, really neat, kind of interesting thing. I didn't do it for deception like people thought. I just did it to try and prevent people from seeing me tip pitches.
And finally, I just wanted to know if we could hear a bit of your insanely accurate Harry Carey impression.
Well, it was funny, man. Like, I love Harry. I kind of got a hybrid of actual Harry, a little bit of Will Ferrell from Saturday Night Live in there. But, you know, I enjoyed talking with Pat Hughes on plane rides and at the ballpark and having him share real Harry Carey stories with me, something that happened with Harry that, and he would tell me different things. And he said, you know, before there was computers, we would have these stacks of papers that you would have to thank people. You had to thank sponsors, or maybe there was birthdays, or, you know, you're saying a happy anniversary to somebody, and they would have these stack of papers on the desk, and then you'd read them off, and you'd throw them away. And one day they took a yellow piece of paper, and they decided to mess with Harry. They wanted to kind of joke around with him, and they said, a busload of gerbils came to the game today. Well, they stuck the stack of papers in there, so they're watching it go on, and all of a sudden, you know, Harry's sitting there, and he said it was just classic Harry because you see this thing go on and all of a sudden he's sitting there, "What a way, you over the top half of the fourth inning, we want to thank the Gerbil family. They took a busted here from Waukegan. We want to thank them for coming by," and he didn't even miss a beat. And, you know, just the fact that the stuff that he would do, you know, and talk out there on the air, it was just, you know, saying hello. "We want to thank Bill with the Kathy Johnson, the old hardware store out there in Winnetka. Hey, Bill, hey, Kathy, thanks for being great fans." And he was just so lovable, and everybody obviously just adored him, and I'm one of those people, and glad I get a chance to relive him through my own impersonations and just stories of Harry Carey.
Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show. It was quite a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely, John. My pleasure, and I'm glad to help out.
Thank you. And once again, I just want to say thank you to Ryan Dempster. This was a great interview, and I was so happy to have him on. We're going to move on now to our final three segments, starting with the odd sports story segment. This comes from the HuffingtonPost.com. Here's the headline, "Teen Accidentally Runs Marathon." And here's some quotes from the article. So, a Pennsylvania teenager's family says he accidentally ran all 26.2 miles of the Philadelphia Marathon because he missed a turn on the half-marathon course. The teenager's name was Evan. He runs on his high school's cross-country team, 80 miles west of Philadelphia. So he set out this day to run a 13.1-mile half-marathon. He never went to the finish line because he took a wrong turn and ended up running the entire 26.2-mile marathon. So that's quite odd. I guess you miss a wrong turn, but in the end, he still finished the 26.2 miles. That is your odd sports story of the day. Here comes your punchline of the day segment. So here's the question. Why doesn't the Philadelphia 76ers have a website? The answer, they can't string three W's together. Although that is true as far as today's sense, watch out for them next year with Ben Simmons, Markel Fultz, and Joel Embiid. That was your punchline of the day segment. And finally, we have our famed announcer's call of the day segment. And for this call, we'll take you back to 2008. It's Cubs versus Cardinals, a 2-2 game in the bottom of the 11th. There's nobody out, bases are loaded, and Henry Blanco former Cubs catcher, is at the plate. Let's listen to Len Casper with the call.
The 0-1 pitch. Line in, the Cubs win! As Torres didn't make the catch, as Derek Lee scores! Henry Blanco with a game-winning hit!
Great call there by Len Casper, and as Ryan Dempster put it, that 2018 was certainly a special one for the Chicago Cubs. And with that, thank you all for listening to this podcast on SportsTalkChicago.com. Hit me up personally on Instagram, Google+, and Twitter, all at John Zags. Make sure to follow the website's Twitter page, at ShyTalkSports. And once again, I'd just like to thank Ryan Dempster for coming on the show. One of my most memorable interviews, shared a lot of stories, talked a lot of Cubs baseball. It was an honor to have him on here today. Thank you all for listening. Have a great day.